And in Mirza Hashem, this should be Le'ilui Nishmasa. The issue of how to maintain spiritual commitment, you know, in a way I could just say I wish I knew the answer, and then I would share it with you and we would immediately bring Mashiach if we had the answer to that particular question. Part of the problem we have, though, is that all of us want instant gratification in everything, including Ruchnius as well as Gashmius. You know, I remember learning when I was in seventh grade about one of the pivotal battles in the War of 1812. Was fought actually 3 weeks after the peace treaty was signed in Belgium. And in fact, Andrew Jackson, who later became President of the United States, won a medal for the Battle of New Orleans, even though it was fought after the war was over. In the olden days, it took months and months to get news from one part of the world to another part of the world. Today, of course, we have fax machines, and I know that if it takes more than 30 seconds for a fax to go through, I'm drumming my fingers on the table. Why is it taking so long for that fax from Israel to come across? So, in effect, our expectations have been heightened. We want things, and we want things now. The notion of fixing something is a bit foreign to our mentality. We throw it out, whether it be Chas v'shalom, not in our circle so much, but whether it be a baby, whether it be a marriage, we throw things out rather than fix them. And so too in Ruchnius as well. We often want the quick fix and the instant gratification, when in fact that is not karchi darka shel Torah, that is not the way one constructs a spiritual life. It is a journey, it is not necessarily a fixed point, it is a process, and one has to be committed to taking that process with all of the work and all of the effort that it entails. In a way, it's very, very fortuitous, and it's certainly no accidents that we're discussing this topic the night of Hanukkah. Let me share with you a basic thought about Hanukkah that one finds in the writings of the Maharal. Everyone knows that when the Gemara in Shabbos describes the significance of the holiday of Hanukkah, it emphasizes only the fact that a little jar of oil was found that was pure, and the oil was only enough to burn for one day, and miraculously HaKadosh Baruch Hu made a nes and it burned 8 days. The Gemara totally de-emphasizes any notion of the fact that the Jewish people overthrew a foreign invader, the Syrian Greeks, and established a monarchy, the Malchus of the Hashmonaim, that lasted for, as the Rambam writes, for almost 200 years before the Roman occupation of Eretz Yisrael. So the Gemara emphasizes only the miracle of the Pach HaShemen, and it totally disregards the Nitzachon, the victory of the Milchama. Conversely, it's a well-known kasha, conversely, if one looks in the Al HaNisim, which we recite both in benching and in Shmona Esrei, one sees no mention at all, or perhaps the most oblique mention, of anything to do with the candles. It mentions at the end they lit candles in the Beis HaMikdash, but it doesn't say there was a miracle. It says the reason we celebrate Hanukkah is exclusively because of Masarta, Gibayrim, Biad Chaloshim, you gave the mighty over to the weak, Rabim, Biad Miatim, the many over to the small, the evildoers over to the righteous, Rishon, Biad Tzadikim, and it doesn't mention the Pach HaShemen. So we have a fundamental contradiction, as it were, regarding what is the essence of the holiday of Hanukkah. Is it a commemoration of a miracle of the Pach HaShemen, or is it a commemoration of the Nitzachon? And the Maharal's approach is that the real thing that one is grateful for in Hanukkah is the Nitzachon of the Milchama. That is really what we're celebrating. After all, you never make a Yom Tov merely because God did a miracle about the oil. I mean, that did not save anybody's life. But the Maharal says it's necessary to commemorate the Pach HaShemen in order to understand what is it in the Nitzachon Milchama that we are grateful for. If we would not associate the Pach HaShemen to the Nitzachon of the Milchama, we might think we're celebrating 4th of July, we might be celebrating Bastille Day, the establishment of a Jewish independent state, and that is certainly not what Chazal want us to celebrate, for a variety of reasons. One can give many reasons. One reason is, as the Ramban points out in Chumash, that the very establishment of the Malchus Hashmonai was contrary to Halacha, because Malchus belonged to Shevet Yehuda. And the Ramban gives another reason based on the Yerushalmi, that a Kohen specifically should not be a Melech, which I believe has some very interesting implications regarding separation of church and state, which I will leave for another time. The other reason why we don't want to celebrate the Malchus Hashmonai in the abstract is because if this was a rebellion against Hellenism and the Malchus Hashmonai eventually became Hellenist, what is it that you celebrate? But the Maral says, the Nitzachon that we are celebrating is the Nitzachon of light over darkness, of wisdom over ignorance, of spirituality over Kedusha. It is that struggle that we are celebrating, and in order to be conscious of the fact that that is the Nitzachon that we are focusing on, Chazal memorialized that Nitzachon by recounting the miracle of the Ner, because there too, that was Or Doches Achoshech, the light pushes away the darkness. So we are celebrating the Nitzachon, but the Nitzachon is a spiritual Nitzachon. And the Maral goes on and explains that the Golus of Yavan, the Golus of Greece, is called the Golus of Choshech, the Golus of darkness. When it says, V'aretz ha'isa sayu v'avayu, the world was confused and empty, and there was Choshech al p'nei tahom, the Medrash says that this is a remez to the four Golios, that Tayhu, the confusion, is Golus of Bavel, and Bayu, the emptiness, is the Golus of Persia and the Gezerah of Haman, and Choshech is the Golus of Yavan, and the Tahaim, the infinite depths, is the Golus of Rome, which we are still into this very day. And the Maral says, why is Yavan called the Golus of Choshech? Because Yavan is a funny type of Golus. We're in Eretz Yisrael. We have a Beis HaMikdash. So what is the Golus? Foreign domination, but what is the essential Golus? The Golus is that when it's dark, you don't see and appreciate what is there, and you see all sorts of things that are not really there. The Golus of Yavan is not a Golus of place. It's a Golus of perception, where a person's heart and mind is not open to holiness. When a person gets their geschmack and gets their excitement and gets their kicks out of everything else that is out there, that is the Golus of Choshech. Now, the truth of the matter is, although we are not, according to this Medrash, in the Golus of Choshech, we're in the Golus of Edom, al p'nei tahom, but the Svarim tell us that the Golus of Edom is not really a separate Golus. The Golus of Edom, the Romans were great imitators. Rome was like Japan. They never create anything original. That in the Golus of Rome, there is a replication of every component of the other Golias. Thus, in Golus Edom, there is the Churban Bais HaMikdash, which corresponds to what happened under Bavel. There is genocide, like Holocaust, which corresponds to Haman's Gezeirah of Persia. And finally, there is Choshech. There is the darkness of perception, which is replicated in our society. You know, if the challenge of the Holocaust was the Golus of genocide, the challenge of life in late 20th century America is the Golus of Choshech, the Golus of darkness, the Golus of perception, in which our hearts and souls are not open. And I'm not only referring to the fact that, unfortunately, in our generation, 90% or more of the Jewish people are not Shomer Mitzvahs, but I'm referring to the fact that even those of us who try to be Shomer Mitzvahs, we live with attitudes of darkness in terms of our souls not being moved and our souls not being stirred. And if, as the Maral says, Chanukah is the time when Hashem shows us that spiritual light can dispel this Choshech, then indeed it's a time where every single year we're given that capacity to absorb within our hearts an ore, which will be Docheh the Choshech. All of us know, when Yaakov Avinu was mispalel 2 weeks ago in Parshas Vayishlach, Hatzileni noam miyad ochi miyad Esav, save me Hashem from my brother, from Esav, the famous vort of the Beis Halevi, that Yaakov is praying for two things. Yaakov is afraid of two things. Yaakov is afraid of the Esav that's coming to kill him. But then Yaakov says, I'm also afraid of the Esav that comes to me as a brother, as a friend, because the Esav that comes to kill me may kill my body, but the Esav that comes as a brother, as a friend, inviting me to share his values and share his perceptions, that's even a greater sakana. That's a sakana to the neshama. And if I may quote Rav Shimshon Afal Hirsch, who once remarked about 19th century orthodoxy in Western Europe, he once said that perhaps we are the opposite of the Muranos. The Muranos were goyim on the outside. It's a harsh word, but again, I'm just quoting refers. I'm not saying it myself. It says, we are goyim on the outside, and Jews, they were goyim on the outside, and Jews on the inside. Perhaps our problem is that on some level we are reverse Muranos, where the accoutrements of Frumkeit, the sociological aspects of being an Orthodox Jew are easier than they ever were before. You know, by and large, some of those battles about Shomer Shabbos in the workplace, the issue of colleges not giving exams on Shabbos, the issue of SATs being delayed, all of those issues, the infrastructure, as it were, has been put in place where it is fairly easy to live an Orthodox life in the United States. We can certainly be Jews on the outside. The next challenge and the bigger challenge is, what's in the inside? Are we the opposite, indeed, of the Muranos? Have we too much become victims, not to the Esav who comes to destroy us, but to the Esav that comes in the guise of Achi, Hatzilenina miyad Achi miyad Esav? And frankly, the very concept of spirituality is something that many of us are uncomfortable with. I've heard it said, when we talk about spirituality, or we talk about God, or we talk about a relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam, people have a funny sense that that sounds almost Christian. I've heard it said, I was talking about this, someone says, only Christians talk about God. Now, the truth of the matter is, that is not a totally absurd statement. There is a certain notion in which we recognize the Ribbono Shel Olam is beyond our comprehension. The Ribbono Shel Olam is Ein Sof in the Lashon of the Mekubalim, etc. So there is indeed a concept where we have to know that there's a certain distance. Ki lo machshev osai, machshev oseichem. That is true. But still, the notion of how rare it is that we consciously think about developing a relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam is really an indictment in terms of how we see all of the trees in the forest, but we don't see the pattern. Like a pointillist painting, you know, that style of painting which just has a million little dots, and we see each dot, but what does it add up to? Again, it's something that we have to think about even in the best chinuch, in the best maestas of chinuch, in the best homes. It is indeed something that we have to give a lot of thought to. So certainly it's very appropriate that in Chanukah, which is the concept of the internalizing the light that can be docha, this choshech of Yavan, this is something that we have to give some thought to. Let me just enumerate very, very quickly certain characteristics that I think we should be striving to internalize in our own life, and each person can make up their own list, but this might be a starting list. First, we have to ask ourselves a lot of very difficult questions. What is truly the priority of our life? What gives our life meaning? What turns us on, to use a vernacular? What is our source of excitements? Viktor Frankl, a very eminent, non-religious, but very eminent Jewish psychotherapist who died a short while ago, developed a whole school of psychology based on his experiences in the concentration camps, logotherapy, which talked about man's search for meaning. That the human being, by definition, because he or she is a godly creature, crave some meaning and significance in their lives. Even children, and perhaps children more so than adults because they have not yet pushed these questions to the side, want to know what life is about. And yet, how often is it that our lives are not devoted to that which has ultimate value, but only to that which is transient? They tell the story about an obsessive compulsive individual who always wanted to be fully prepared. It's really an adaptation of an old Dibner Magid mashal, but it's jazzed up a little and modernized a little bit. And the obsessive compulsive individual had to be fully prepared for everything. At the age of 65, after retirement, he was about to take his first trip to Israel, but he was told there would be a 7-hour stopover in France. So not wanting to be left unprepared, he spent the year before the trip studying French, so he would be prepared to order a Coca-Cola in the Paris airport. He was very proud of himself. He arrived at the airport, he could order Coke like a native. But alas, when the 7 hours were over, he realizes with a sickening feeling that he never bothered to learn Hebrew. The mashal that this is all of us are here on this world only for a short time. Mirtz Hashem, it should be Mea V'Yesrim Shana, in good health, but it's not forever. In this world, there are a variety of skills that we have to learn. Right? We have to, generally speaking, we have to have a job, we have to have a parnasa, we have to learn how to run carpool, we have to know how to take clothes to the cleaners. There are a lot of things that one indeed needs to know to manage life in this world. But if one puts all of their energies and all of their kochos into how does one simply deal with the physical details of existence, then one is simply missing the ultimate priority and the ultimate goal. This is true even if we go outside the narrow confines of Frumkeit. If you look in terms of the relationships that husbands have with wives, the relationships of parents to children, there was a survey that I had seen a while ago that indicates that the average amount of time, this is not limited to the Jewish community, this is nationwide, the average amount of minutes that husbands and wives speak to each other about matters other than housekeeping detail is less than 20 minutes a week. That was the average. In the lives that we live, there is basically no way to maintain relationships on a sufficiently high level. And indeed, it's been said, if people would invest a fraction of the time in their marriages that they do in their jobs, the divorce rate would be halved. Once again, obviously, this is not the only reason to argue for a Shabbos, but certainly in the Ribbono Shel Olam's infinite wisdom, one of the great, great benefits of a Shabbos, which is sometimes underutilized even by firm homes, is that it is a time indeed when this kesher to one's family can be strengthened and developed. Again, that's not the only reason, but again, in a Kaddish Baruch Hu's cheshbon, obviously this is one of the great, great benefits of a day like Shabbos, which is such an avla when we waste it and we don't use it. The notion of priorities is illustrated in another funny mashal that is said. A chassid once asked his rebbe, he says, why are you better than me? You know, when I'm hungry, I make a bracha, a brei pri eitz, and I eat the apple. You make a brei pri eitz, you eat the apple. What's the difference between you and me? We make the same bracha, maybe even the same kavana. And the rebbe says, no, there's a pashat nafkamina. How do you approach the bracha? In the middle of the day, you get starving. Say, I have to eat. No, so I look around for something I can eat. And then I say, well, I can't eat unless I make a bracha. So I make a bracha. In other words, your attitude is you make the bracha because you want to eat. With me, it's the opposite. I don't think of food. In the middle of the day, I'm struck with this uncontrollable longing to be Meshabeach the Ribbono Shel Olam. And I look around, is there any way I can praise the Ribbono Shel Olam? Nebuch, you can't make a bracha unless you eat something. All right, so I'll pick up the apple. So the question is, does one make the bracha in order to eat, or does one eat in order to make the bracha? The question is, what is that which gives a person priority? And I've noticed myself, and again, I am prone to this myself, if there's anything that happens to grab my fancy, that sometimes a Rav could be giving a shiur, and people are listening, some people falling asleep, some people listening, at various levels of interest. And then somebody comes in with the result of the Super Bowl that day. And all of a sudden, such a geschmack, such a slavas, such excitement. And Taka, why? Good, I happen not to be a football fan, so good. I'm not claiming to be a tzaddik. That's not my Yetzirah, but there might be something else. The question is, why? Why is it that we respond with a visceral sense of excitement to all sorts of things, whether it be sports, whether it be gossip, whether it be even Jewish Lashon Hara, about what was said about this person, what was said about that person. But to the Devar Hashem, to the words of Hashem, to the words of our davening, to the chance to be omed in a shul, or even at home, in tefillah, in prayer to the Ribbono Shel Olam, somehow that excitement isn't there. What is it indeed that gives priority and meaning to our lives? A second difficult question we have to ask ourselves, again, these are interrelated, these are not distinct, is the issue of, are we doing mitzvahs mechanically, or are we thinking about the meaning of what it is that we're doing? Here, there's an interesting maisa with the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim, when he was traveling around selling his svarim, once spent Shabbos in a person's home. The person was very, very honored to have such a chashav of a person, one of the gedolim, in his home. And when he came home, he noticed that his wife forgot or did not yet cover up the chalos before Kiddush. As you know, the challah is covered up before Kiddush. And the man was very agitated because he was embarrassed that the Chafetz Chaim came to his home and somehow his wife didn't do it totally proper. So the man starts, in an agitated way, starts yelling at his wife, didn't I tell you every Shabbos before Kiddush cover up the challah? Don't you know this? And you're embarrassing me and we have a chush of a guest. So the Chafetz Chaim interrupts the person's tirade and says to the person, tell me, you know, maybe you know how to learn better than I. Why is it so that you have to cover up the challah? Tell me the reason. And of course, there are a lot of reasons, but the main reason that is given in halacha is we don't want to embarrass the bread, because normally we begin a meal with hamotzi, but Friday night we begin it with the bracha over the wine, so the bread might feel humiliated, so we either don't bring the bread to the table, like the Rambam says, or we bring it and it's covered up, so the pas shouldn't be embarrassed. So the Chafetz Chaim says, so I see. It's very laudable that in your concern for sparing the bread, shame, you're willing to embarrass your wife. Now, this is a simple story, but it does contain a profound point. You know, Baruch Hashem, in this age, we have tremendous amounts of halachic literature in English, and sometimes the monographs are very, very narrow. For example, there's a big book on the Isser of davening within somebody's four amas, so one could probably write a whole book on the details of covering challis. When do you do it? Do you have to cover up the cake? Right? There are different halachic shailas that are involved. And one could go through all of their life, going through all of the Rishonim and Achronim, dealing with covering challah. But the Chafetz Chaim's point is, one can keep a mitzvah with all of its dikdukim, all of its details, all of its pratim, and still miss the picture. The bread does not feel embarrassment in any particular way that we understand this. But rather, we have certain rituals, we have certain mitzvos, which are designed to teach us something about sensitivity. It's not so much that the bread gets embarrassed, but you behave in a respectful way, even towards the inanimate, so that you learn how to respect human dignity and covet habrios. In fact, it's even true, we find, for example, that sometimes people are very, very zahir in kavod hames, like the old saying, even in English, you don't speak evil about the dead. But the truth of the matter is, in other words, people are very happy to speak evil about someone when he's alive, but when he's dead, all of a sudden. But the truth of the matter is, although Judaism would also subscribe very much to not to say anything bad about the dead, but the concept is, we have halachos pertaining to the honor of a dead body, because that was once the repository of a neshama, and therefore we owe that dead body kavod. Indeed, there are many halachas regarding kavod ameis, but kal v'chomer, therefore, we have to show that kavod and that respect to someone that's alive. There's no concept that you honor the dead more than you honor somebody that's alive, although it's very ingrained in us, you don't speak evil about the dead. The Chafetz Chaim's point, once again, is that you can't miss the boat here. Mitzvot are designed, as Chazal say, letzarev is a brius, to elevate us, to sensitize us, to teach us midos, to teach us sensitivity, to teach us rachmanos. And even in the ritualistic mitzvot, in other words, certainly in the mitzvot bein adam lechavero, that's obviously the case. But even in the purely ritualistic mitzvot, we have to be willing to express those values. And how often in our chinuch, both at home and in the schools, do we want to emphasize that particular point? Perhaps we are spending, I don't want to say too much time, because certainly the pratim of halacha are very, very important, but those pratim need to be balanced with the hashkafa that teaches the idea of the spiritual meaning of these mitzvos and how they can be exemplified and carried over in our interactions, both bein adam l'chaveiro and ultimately towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu as well. In this sense, there's another mitzvah with the Chafetz Chaim, Rav Schwab Zatzal. When he was a young man, he had a meeting with the Chafetz Chaim. He met the Chafetz Chaim towards the end of the Chafetz Chaim's life, and Rav Schwab used to love to discuss in many times and in many contexts the various conversations he had with the Chafetz Chaim. In fact, Klal Yisrael has learned a lot from Rav Schwab's recounting of his interactions with the Chafetz Chaim. And the two things that Schwab used to say over a lot is that the Chafetz Chaim asked Rav Schwab, "Are you a Kohen?" And Rav Schwab said no. And then the Chafetz Chaim says, "Was your father a Kohen?" Rav Schwab says no. He says, "Was your grandfather a Kohen?" So at this point, Rav Schwab understood there must have been some meaning to the question. And the Chafetz Chaim says, "Well, you know, I'm a Kohen, and my father's a Kohen, and my grandfather's a Kohen." Okay. He says, "And you know why?" He said, "Because thousands of years ago, when there was an Egel HaZahav, and Moshe Rabbeinu called out, 'Mi Lashem Eli, who is for God should come to me,' the Chafetz Chaim said, 'My great-grandfather stepped forward, and yours didn't.' And because of that, there was that distinction." And he told Rav Schwab, "Make sure that when Hashem calls you in every generation, 'Mi Lashem Eli,' you step forward, so that your great-great-grandchildren will not be in the same position that your great-great-grandfather left you when he didn't step forward." That's one point Rav Schwab recounts from the Chafetz Chaim. The second point, which is more connected to this idea of doing mitzvahs with thought, thank you, is, we all know the Medrash that says that the man tasted like whatever you wanted it to taste like. Except onions and garlic for nursing mothers, that would not be good for the milk. But you know, if you wanted it to be ice cream or steak. So Chafetz Chaim asked Rav Shraub, what did the man taste like if you weren't thinking? What if you were mindlessly chewing the man like people chew gum? What did you taste? So Shraub had no idea. So the Chafetz Chaim says, I'll tell you. You didn't taste anything. Because man is ruchnius. Man is spiritual food. Man is not material food. And ruchnius has no taste unless you think about it. You know, the Chafetz Chaim is being madgish once again that when we do mitzvos, they have to be done with the machshava. Because without that machshava, there's not going to be taste. There's not going to be tam. And tamu uru ki tof Hashem, David HaMelech says, if you taste and you see, you will see the goodness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Again, they tell a maisa. Again, it's an old Hasidish maisa. They tell a maisa about how we sometimes confuse the ultimate meaning with the superficial, about a gevir, a wealthy man, who gave people the opportunity that when you ate at his house, you could take whatever you wanted. You could take a gift, take a souvenir home. So there was a poor fellow who was invited to this person's house, and he noticed between every course the person rang a bell. And as soon as he rang a bell, the servants appeared bringing food, etc. And then he rang the bell again, and the servants appeared and cleaned off the table, and he rang again, and they brought dessert, and they brought drinks and coffee. So he figured this must be a magic bell. So when the gevir asked the person, what would you like to take home? He says, I want that bell. So the gevir gave him the bell. So he goes home to his wife, and he tells to his wife, and there's no food in his house at all, invite the guests, we're making a party. I'm going to invite everybody in the house. And his wife says, you're crazy. We have nothing in the house at all. He says, set the table. I will take care of everything. So she invites the whole town, and they show up. And he starts ringing the bell, and ringing the bell, and ringing the bell, and nothing happens at all. And he goes back to the gevir and says, why did you switch bells on me? You gave me the wrong bell. But again, the mashal is that it's not the bell that does it. It's the resources that you bring to the bell. If you prepare yourself, if you work, if you accumulate, if you organize, if you put all those forces in motion, then the bell can indeed do wonderful things. But if all you do is the bell, and you don't have the resources, then indeed nothing's going to happen. And again, this is sometimes a mashal for the way we taka do mitzvahs. So this is yet another issue that we have to raise, and that is, have we lost, Bavon Aseinu HaRabim, have we lost the forest by focusing on the trees? Now again, it's a difficult issue. I realize it's a difficult issue because one might say, well, isn't that the way conservative and reform Jews talk? They talk about the fact that we shouldn't be preoccupied with details, we should look at values, etc. Indeed, that is a rhetoric that is sometimes employed as an excuse not to be meticulous in halacha. In chas v'shalom, that is obviously not my kavana. Any Jew that is a maimon in Torah min Hashemayim and in the Kayach of the Chachamim knows that doing these mitzvahs is the only way one can have a meaningful relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam. But one has to recognize that that is the foundation of a relationship. But that is not the end of that relationship. Meaning that is the beginning, that is not the end. And sometimes we make it the end when in fact it is just the first step that needs to be built upon, and we never go beyond that particular level. A third issue we have to ask ourselves is, have we inculcated both in ourselves and in our families and in our children a sense of the joy and simcha in being an Eved Hashem? All of us know the Ari's famous interpretation when it says in the Tokacha, Tachas asher lo yavadata es Hashem alokecha b'simcha. Because you did not serve God, enjoy the Ari. So Ari translates the pasuk that even when you serve Hashem, if it is not besimcha, that could cause all of the curses and all of the chorban. Rav Meisha used to say that the old Yiddish saying "Tzshver tzayin yid," it's hard to be a Jew, which is what you know what was said by the generations of immigrants that came to this country. Rav Meisha felt that destroyed a whole generation because it conveyed to a new generation that was born in America the notion that if being a Jew is rough, if being a Jew is hard, if being a Jew is a burden, which for some reason the old folks were keeping it, then why should I in a free country assume that burden? Rav Moshe says the attitude that needs to be conveyed is that of privilege, that of joy. But in this connection, one has to understand that indeed, that does not mean it's easy to be a Jew. In other words, in effect, Shvertze Zayin Yid is true in another sense. And here, I recall something I remember reading from Rav Noach Weinberg. And this was actually in a very unlikely source. Perhaps some of the older folks remember this. This goes back to the 1970s in Rolling Stone magazine. I'm sure it's available in Muncie in a number of places. But anyway, in Rolling Stone magazine, there was a reporter, Ellen Willis, who wrote a story about her brother who went to Eretz Yisrael in Rolling Stone. And he became a Baal Tshuva. He became a Baal Tshuva. And obviously, this shocked his family because they thought it was a cult. And she, as a reporter, went to Eretz Yisrael to interview Rav Noach and to interview a number of the Baalei Tshuvas and the institutions to kind of describe what is going on, what is this phenomenon of Chozer B'Tshuva. Actually, it's a wonderful article. And she was very honest, and I don't know where she is today, but she was really on the verge of becoming almost from herself, and at the last minute she pulled back, at least as far as the article went. I'm not sure what happens after the article. So she writes about a conversation she had with Rav Noach Weinberg. Rav Noach Weinberg, if you've ever met him, is a very, very persuasive individual, very charismatic, very persuasive. He can kind of convince you to do many, many things. And he was engaged in a dialogue with her, and he asked her, "What is it that human beings seek above all?" So she gave a relatively superficial answer, which he was willing to accept, and that is, they want pleasure. Human beings, of course, that's the same thing as every other animal, seek pleasure. He says, okay, I will even accept that. A human being wants pleasure. He then asked her, what is the opposite of pleasure? And she responded, the opposite of pleasure is pain. He said, no, that's not true. The opposite of pleasure is comfort. So she didn't understand. She says, I'm sure if I take out a Webster's dictionary and I look up pleasure, it'll give comfort as a synonym, not an opposite. He says, no, they are in fact opposite. Pleasure in life is the feeling that you get when there has been struggle, when you have pushed yourself. Even if you're talking about something as relatively superficial as you want to be an ice skating champion, you want to be the best basketball player in high school, so you get up 5 o'clock in the morning, and you practice, and you work, and you struggle, and then you achieve something, that feeling is what we could describe as pleasure. Comfort is when you decide not to get out of bed because it's too hard. Rav Noach said, the real opposite of pleasure is to live a life of comforts. Judaism never claims to be comfortable. In that sense, it is indeed shver zu zayin yid. It is a struggle. But Judaism does indeed claim to be pleasurable. It is the pleasure of struggling against the odds, of making sacrifices, of being ehrlich and honest in business, even when there are those around you, including maybe your fellow Shomer Shabbos Yidden, who may not be playing by those same rules. And in the short term, there may be sacrifices. But a person can go to bed at night saying, I've tried my hardest to be an Oved Hashem. And there is indeed a certain pleasure. There is a pleasure in feeling the closeness of the Ribono Shel Olam, even as one goes through adversity and difficulty and hardship, because one has that kesher to the Ribono Shel Olam. So in a way, again, Rav Moshe's point that Shvertze Zayin Yid destroyed a generation because of the negativism, the pessimism that it conveyed. But we have to understand that indeed there is something noble about a struggle. And that goes back to the instant gratification, where we live in a world where maybe it's too easy to be a Jew. Lubavitcher Rebbe used to remark that sometimes it's easier to be a Jew in Siberia than suburbia. That somehow when it's too easy, maybe that's a problem as well. That indeed it is the struggle that can ennoble a person and make a person stronger and give a person that kesher with the Ribono Shel Olam. But in either events, it must come in a spirit of joy, a spirit of happiness. How do we observe our Shabbosim, our Yomim Tovim? Do we simply use them as an excuse to get to bed as soon as possible, or to discuss the news, or to read about the sports scores? Or do we use them to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu with simcha? And it's lav davka Shabbos. This could even be in a regular davening, a regular learning. Are we conveying the joy of Yiddishkeit, or are we conveying it as a burden and something that we'd rather avoid because we look for the least common denominator to be able to be yaitzei our chiyuvim? It's interesting, there's a marsha in Brachas, you know, recently the Daf Yomi celebrated its first siyum since the siyum mashas, the siyum of Maseches Brachas. And if you remember, the end of Maseches Nida is the famous Maimer Chazal, Kol Hashayna Halachas B'chal Yayim. Anyone that learns halachas every day, muftachlo, is assured that they are a ben olam haba. They are a child of olam haba. The Maharsha remarks that there's a difference between being a ben olam haba, which refers to the relationship of a child, a son to a father, and being an eved. Sometimes we describe our relationship to Hashem as an eved to a master, and sometimes we describe it as a parent to a child. The Maharsha says, Shaina halachas means someone who learns those parts of the Torah even if they're not directly relevant to his daily practice. He gives kind of an unusual interpretation of halacha. It does not refer to what you need to know on a day-to-day basis, but it refers to more theoretical knowledge. And the Maharsha says, when one looks at the Ribono Shel Olam as a master, and I'm just an Eved does the bare minimum to get by. If I need to know one halacha, I'll do one thing. But if one is a child, and a child loves a parent, a child wants to know everything about a parent. A child wants to know, where were you from 1941 to 1942? Where did you live? Where was your house? And the Maharsha writes, the relationship of a Jew to HaKadosh Baruch Hu should be one of a child who wants to know everything that child can know about the parent. And of course, the way we know is through the learning of Hashem's Torah and the like. So that is the issue of joy. And in that connection, I should also mention that part of living a life of joy is to be inculcated with the midah of Hakaras HaTov for life. And of course, I should emphasize that Chanukah is described in Halacha very specifically as days of Hallel, which is Hallel v'hoda'ah, gratitude. You know, there's a beautiful vort from the Sfas Emes. The Sfas Emes says, why are Jews called Yehudim? After all, Yehuda is only one tribe. Why is all of the Jewish people called Yehudim? So he says very beautifully, he says, Leah called her fourth son Yehuda. Why? Right? Because she said, Pam Odes Hashem, now I am grateful to Hashem. Rashi explains, because Leah saw with Ruach HaKodesh that Yaakov would have 12 Shvatim, 12 boys, and there are four wives. So she figured, the first three are coming to me. But when she has number four, she got more, Nataldi, Yeser al-Chelki. So that is what gratitude is. Gratitude comes when a person feels they've gotten more than is coming to them. The Sfas Emes says, every Jew is called a Yehudi, because every Jew must go through life with the feeling that Hashem has given me more than my chelek. And that, of course, is inextricably bound up with seeing joy in Avodas Hashem. When we say in benching, it says, it might be Pashut, but it's worthwhile ha'ara. It says in the end of benching, Nar ha'isi gam zakanti, I was a young man and now I'm old. V'lo ra'isi tzadik nezav, I have never seen a tzaddik abandoned, v'zarei mevakesh lachem, and his children having to beg for bread. It's a shver pasuk. I've seen children of tzaddikim begging for bread. Why hasn't David HaMelech seen them? I'm sure he has. But I would suggest, and I think some of us say this, you can translate the pasuk a little differently. He doesn't mean to say, I never saw a tzaddik abandoned and his children begging for bread, but it means, I never saw a tzaddik who felt that he was abandoned by the Ribono Shel Olam, even though it's Zaro Mevakesh Lachem. In other words, it is a statement regarding the resilience and the attitude of a righteous and a Maimon that, in spite of the difficulties in life, they felt, Natalti Yeser al Chelki, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given me good. And my relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is good and strong, and this is what sustains me, and this is what gives me chias, even though it's zarei mevakesh lachem. So we've spoken very briefly about what is our priority in life. Do we give thought to the mitzvahs that we do? Do we try to inculcate in our avodas Hashem joy and gratitude for life? Let me mention something else, which is an issue that is unfortunately very much omed al haperek, and I don't want to get into anything specific, but I want to address it at least in a general sense. And that is, do we teach, and when I say teach our children, but also with our, within ourselves, do we try to embody within our own persona a combination of tolerance, respect, with commitment to emes? You know, living in this world is inherently a conflict. And of course, the Medrash says this in Parshas Bereishis, between two kochos, and that is emes, which is truth, fidelity to principle, commitment to that which is right. And then there's another value, which is the value of shalom, peace, accommodation, tolerance, acceptance, respect. We live in a world where these midos have tended to be polarized, so that we can often identify people that might be called anshei emes, people of truth, people of principle, people of total commitments, but often it is at the expense of shalom, at the expense of respect, of opening up, of trying to see the goodness that can exist within everyone. And conversely, we see in the world sometimes there's a koach of shalom, but the koach of shalom is diluted to an I'm okay, you're okay, to a religious and moral relativism, where every ideology is acceptable, because in effect, MS is sacrificed at the altar of shalom, or sometimes shalom is sacrificed at the altar of MS. If we look, however, at the very role models that the Torah tells us to emulate, and we look, for example, at Avraham Avinu, and we see in Avraham Avinu's own life that on one level, Avraham Avinu is described as Ivri. Ivri means from the other side of the river, and besides the literal interpretation that this comes from east of the Euphrates, Chazal say that being on the other side of the river means that Avraham Avinu was able to stand on one side in terms of his beliefs and emunah, even if the entire world rejected him. The strength of a commitment, even if everybody thought he was crazy. potential, even for the greatest Rishonim and evildoers. What would be the case, and again, I don't want to get into very specific things, but what would be the case if Bizman Hazeh, let's assume a Chashev Yid would go to 42nd Street, I understand 42nd Street is now cleaned up, so it's not the same situation, and start offering prayer services on behalf of all of the degenerates that are there, and would ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu's mercy to bring them to tshuva. One could imagine various proclamations or hachrezos saying, well, so-and-so was a great Talmud Chacham, but he is misguided in his love for those who are unworthy. Well, I don't know. I don't know firsthand if the people in 42nd Street are less worthy than the people of Sodom. And yet Avraham Avinu felt that it was kedai to be mispalel, to care about them, to try to see their potential, to try to be makarev them, to whatever degree any type of kirev would have been possible. We see now, I often get questions about people who are chozrei b'tshuva, and they want to know, should they let their children see their grandparents, because their grandparents are not necessarily as frum as the parents want their children to be raised at. And it's very, very sad, because I will say this, generally speaking, to use one's Yiddishkeit as a way of barriers, as a way of rejecting, as a way of closing doors, as a way of disparagement, is not the derech of Hashem. Again, there might be very specific instances where separation and quarantine might be necessary. For example, a grandparent lahakas is giving a child non-kosher food. That would be a very, very different situation. But to simply be exposed to someone of a different hashkafa, and to feel that that's so poisonous that we have to build barriers and mechitzas, in a way seems to be counter to this notion of trying to balance an emes and a shalom in our lives. Now, I don't have a clear answer to this, because clearly emes must be taught and shalom must be taught. How do you balance the emes and the shalom? But I fear that sometimes in our religious societies, perhaps the balance has gone too far in one direction, in which there is disparagement, there is name-calling, there is beetle, just not seeing the goodness that can exist. And by Avnasein HaRabim, one should know that if those who are not yet Shomer Mitzvos feel disparaged and insulted and rejected, then this only creates much more Chilul Hashem and the potential that we would have to perhaps make positive changes is going to be greatly, greatly diminished. So it reminds me of a maisa in which I once saw how a boy from a totally irreligious background did a tremendous Kiddush Hashem. There was a fellow who comes from my part of the country, and he moved to Eretz Yisrael, and he became frum. And not only did he become frum, but he became a ger chassid. So he had a shtray, he had a spadak, and he had knickers, he had all the nine yards. And he got married to a chassidish young lady, who was a Meir Shorim. And I happened to have been in Eretz Yisrael at the time, so I was invited to the wedding. And his parents came from Virginia, Northern Virginia. Now, I felt a little out of place, because, you know, it wasn't my usual milieu, but I can tell you the parents must have felt this was the Twilight Zone. This was totally, you know, first of all, everyone's talking Yiddish. The parents don't know Yiddish at all. The father was wearing a big button that says, "Please don't smoke in my presence," and of course, the Yidden and Meir Sharm are puffing away. Again, that's another serious problem. So the parents really didn't know what was going on. I mean, there was nothing to which they could relate. And of course, they see their son, who looks like a creature from another planet as well. And they hadn't seen him since he had left. You know, it was like, what's going on? Anyway, in the middle of the Suda, the Chassan got up to speak. And he spoke in Yiddish a little bit for the benefit of the crowd. And then he turned to his parents and he said, he wanted to thank them for what they did for him. And he said, you know, 90% of what I am is from you. And the 10% that isn't is because you gave me the courage to strike my own way. So you talk about, you know, does one use tshuva, does one use religiosity as a way of creating barriers? Or does one recognize Tairez Durachaha Darche Noam? And ultimately, it's a way in which a connection can be deepened. And this was just a tremendously moving and admirable quality which shows that maybe emes and shalom are not necessarily as far apart as we sometimes think in our polarized, dichotomized situation. A final quality I think we have to ask about is courage. Now, courage, of course, Pirkei Avos itself says, Ezehu Gibor, who is a courageous person, Hakovesh Yitzro, the person who can conquer the Yetzirah. It's a well-known Maimer Chazal. And of course, courage can take place in many, many forms. When you're talking, let's say, to a kid that goes to a public high school, the courage might be don't take drugs and don't engage in premarital sex if everyone else is doing it. That's courage. That's gevura. That's kovesh yitzra. But even for those of us who are zoche to be in relatively sheltered environments, and I should say, by the way, that the problems I indicated are not totally absent even from our sheltered society, but even without those extreme problems, there is a certain amount of courage that we have to have in our day-to-day life as well, in terms of business ethics in particular, Ehrlichkeit in business, in terms of being willing, let's say, to spend the time and effort in our tefillah, even if sometimes in shul people are davening much faster than we're comfortable in. Is there courage not to speak Lashon Hara when your best friends want to gossip? This is also courage. This is gevura. And we have to learn not to give in to peer pressure. Maybe not to make the most expensive bas mitzvah or chasna or bar mitzvah, I should say, or chasna, because we're embarrassed about the peer pressure. But we make a decision not to give in to that pressure if it's not ultimately good for the family. This is the quality of courage. And if one simply lives a religious life because it's convenient, because it's easy, because it's expedient, because it's what everybody else does, and one does not develop that quality of courage, of being ivri, then one is missing an important dimension of Avodas Hashem. And indeed, as I said before, perhaps that's a real cost in Yiddishkeit being relatively easier than it was, that we don't have as many occasions. But in the little list that I gave, we do have enough in which we have to develop that quality of courage. You know, it's brought down that even in Hilchas Treifas, you know, there's a halacha of a treifa. If an animal falls off a building and its skeleton may have been dislocated, so it may become a treifa under certain circumstances. So one of the ways you check whether there's been some permanent damage is you see if the animal swims. If the animal can swim, that's a sign that it did not become a treifa. If it cannot swim, then it actually kind of reminds me of the Salem witch trials. You know, one of the things they used to do is they would throw the woman into the water. If she drowned, she wasn't a witch. It was okay. If she survived, she was. It's a nebuch for the animal, I think. But anyway, I mean, presumably you save the animal. But it's brought down in halacha that swimming is a raya only if it swims against the current. Because if it swims with the current, shteit, that's not a raya, because even a dead animal can be carried with the currents. And this is said to be a mashal for what it means to have a real Yiddish life. If all one is doing is following the currents, that's not a sign of life, because a dead animal can follow the current as well. There has to be a willingness and a courage to be able to buck the currents when that's necessary as well. And as I say, what that nisayon is will vary from person to person, ranging from drugs, alcohol, you know, all sorts of things, to issues of business ethics, to issues of tefillah, to issues of lashon hara, to issues of anger, etc. But that is the sign of what a Jew is. Ezehu Gibor HaKovesh Yitzro. And of course, the Chovas HaLevavos brings the mashal. It's a pasuk in Mishlei. Umoshel, in fact, is the source of the Mishnah. Umoshel Barucho Milo Chedir. He who governs his spirit is greater than one who conquers a city. And the Chovas HaLevavos brings the mashal of the general who came home after a victorious campaign. And the Chacham of the city went out to tell him, says, Yashakalach on the easy battle. And now you have to wage the much more difficult battle. The battle against the enemy that is within, and not just the enemy that is out there. So these are some of the questions we have to ask ourselves, both in terms of our own Avodas Hashem, and in terms of the chinuch, the education that we are giving our children. I should emphasize, too, that sometimes we tend to think about these things only in connection with our children, as opposed to thinking about them in connection with ourselves, that's a very big mistake. Rav Futner used to say that if a child is told not to talk during davening, then that child will learn that when he grows up, he should tell his child not to talk during davening. But he's not going to learn not to talk during davening because the parent is talking during davening. He says, the real hashpah you have on a child, as any parent knows, is not what you tell the child, but it's how you live the life. I remember a Board of Education meeting I was attending a few years ago in which the Board of Education was discussing what new subjects they could add on to the children's school day. Now, the day was already going till 5, but we could add, you know, extra mishmor here and mishmor here. Now, I knew some of the parents, and I knew that some of the parents and how they spent their evenings, etc., and it was not necessarily over a daf gemara. And I said, listen, you want your kids to learn more Torah, but they're already, you know, they're kind of overextended. Why don't you make an example of sitting down and learning, either with them or they should see you doing it? You know, the concept is we're very, very willing. In fact, there's even a saying, a person has no yetzahara regarding his kids. But we're very, very willing to impose, but we're not necessarily willing to make those sacrifices ourselves. But nevertheless, one should know that those sacrifices and that what the parent does, as opposed to what the parent says, ultimately has a much greater hashpa and a much greater koach. Let me just end, or I actually have another part here that I want to talk about. We know that when Chazal tell us that the Yevanim were specifically directed against certain mitzvos, we know that there were three mitzvos that the Yevanim wanted to take away from the Jewish people. In particular, there was Shabbos, the observance of Shabbos, which of course is the covenant between the bris between Bnei Yisrael and Hashem. There was Reish Chodesh, which of course represents the power of the Jew over time, because Reish Chodesh is an amazing thing, because Reish Chodesh, it depends on when Beis Din makes Reish Chodesh, so Beis Din can determine when Pesach will be, etc. And the third was Bris Milah, circumcision. Bris Milah is something that anyone that has a son has gone through the nachas of seeing the child nichnas into the bris of Avraham Avinu, but we tend not to think about it except for that particular day. You know, when we have a son, an einikol, whatever it is, we think about a bris milah then. But one has to remember, in a very obvious sense, the bris is called an os bris. It is a sign of a covenant between a Jew and Hashem. What is the, in other words, it is a sign of a covenant. So we then have to ask, what is the covenant in particular? What is the covenant of which the bris is a physical sign, or which the milah rather is a physical sign? And I would suggest that perhaps, again, just a partial list, there are perhaps 5 different ideas that we can garner just from contemplating the bris milah. What is the bris milah and what covenant does it represent? First and foremost, if a bris is done bismana, the 8th day, it is obviously involuntary. The child was not consulted. I mean, sometimes an adult, of course, has to get a bris if he didn't get one as a child, but in the normal order of things, a bris is involuntary. So the first thing it reminds us is as Pirkei Avos says, Al karchecha atachai v'al karchecha atanolat. We don't come into the world with a choice. Hashem has given us responsibilities. Hashem has given us missions. Our choice is whether we will do it with joy, whether we will do it with gratitude, whether we'll do it with enthusiasm. That is our choice. But the mission itself is given to us. It is not our prerogative to turn it down. The second aspect of a bris is that it does involve a certain element of pain. Of course, some people say it's more pain for the parents than for the child. In fact, at a very young age, the nervous system is not fully developed, and even when a child cries, it might be because of cold, it might be for other factors. But still, there's a certain element of pain, and this is reflected in the halacha, the minhag of Ashkenazim, at least in Chutz La'aretz, that we do not recite a Shechiyanu at a bris, because indeed, there's Sar Liyanuka. And that goes back to the idea that the covenant, the pleasure versus comfort idea, that the covenant that we have with Hashem does involve certain elements of struggle, does involve, in our history, even bloodshed at times, that indeed it's not going to be an easy road. Lesson number three, and this is already brought down in the Sefer Achinuch, that the bris milah, which is done on the portion of the anatomy which one thinks is least prone to rational control, the involuntary, the aver, teaches us that we have to sanctify every part of our lives, not just the spiritual, but even the material and the physical. And this is a fundamental yesod in Yiddishkeit. We live lives of fragmentation and dichotomy, where we have learning and davening, which is kadosh, and then we have our business and our physical, material lives, which are chol, and we don't build any bridge or anything connecting them. Bris Milah says it's the avoda of a human being to sanctify that gashmias, sanctify that material existence. That the way we conduct our business, the way we eat, the way we sleep, the way we play football and basketball, and the way we go engage in entertainment of any sort, that can also be done in a spirit of Kedusha. And of course the Rambam tells us, and Mechanchim have told their children this for years, the famous Rambam, that if one even goes on vacation or goes on recess with the intention of trying to strengthen themselves so they could serve Hashem properly, then the recess becomes a mitzvah. Or at least the recess becomes a stepping stone in the Avodas Hashem. And the Rambam quotes the Pasuk, B'chol d'rachecha do'eyu, you know Hashem in all of your ways. And the Bris Milah tells us we have to sanctify that physical part of our being as well. Here there's a beautiful thought from Rav Tzadok HaKohen. Rav Tzadok HaKohen points out in the Aseres HaDibros, we find that before the Aseres HaDibros were given, so there was Kolos, right? There was thunder, and Kolos Ubrakim, thunder and lightning flashes. And then the Aseres HaDibros are given, and then afterwards it again repeats, Kola Amrayim, everybody saw things, but there's a minor little variation that you'd almost miss, and that is instead of saying Kolos Ubrakim, which is thunder and lightning, it says kolos velapidim, thunder and torches. Rav Tzadok is omed on the fact, why pre-Matan Torah, the visualization is a lightning flash, and after Matan Torah, the visualization is a torch. And he says, there is a chiluk between the idea of Kedusha before the Torah was given, in the idea of Kedusha after the Torah was given. Even before the Torah was given, the human neshama had a desire for holiness. But the holiness could be realized only by asceticism and withdrawal from this world. This world would pull you down, so if you were holy, you separated this from this world, and you repudiated through chastity, through poverty, through whatever it was. That type of Kedusha, Rav Tzadok says, is analogous to a brilliant flash of lightning, which there's a moment of great light, and then a second later, you're plunged into total darkness. Because even the hermit has to eat, even the hermit has to sleep, even the hermit has to get down from the hill to get the supplies and go into town. Matan Torah was mechadesh. Matan Torah innovated a new way in becoming close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That one can live a life of holiness, not by repudiation and escape, but by taking even the physical world and elevating it and sanctifying it. That is no longer lightning. And in fact, Rav Tzadok actually writes, there's a certain tragic compromise here, inevitably. Because on one level, the holiness that you're going to feel when you're engaged in mundane life, when you're doing carpool, when you're doing cleaning, when you're doing all of these things, is not going to be as exciting and as ecstatic as the flash of lightning. It's not going to give you that kick all the time. Because it's the Ratzon Hashem that we sanctify this world, a world of Hester Panim, a world of darkness. But Rav Tzadok says, it'll give you warmth, which lightning doesn't do. It'll give you sufficient light, it'll flicker. But if you have to navigate the curves of life, lightning is a very dangerous guide, because if the road is curving, the lightning doesn't give you enough of a view to know how to navigate. The torch will. And Rav Tzadok says, the shift from lightning to torch is the transformation of holiness that is abstracted from reality into a holiness that can be integrated within the framework of everyday life, and that is the third lesson of Bris Mila, to sanctify the physical. A fourth lesson of Bris Mila, and this goes back to a medrash, and the Beis Halevi elaborates on this medrash, is that the Bris Mila, the medrash asks, a matronis asked Rabbi Akiva, a Roman princess asked Rabbi Akiva, if Hashem wanted Jewish boys to be circumcised, why didn't he create them circumcised? And the medrash answers, HaKadosh Baruch Hu left a certain amount of the world incomplete so that we become partners with HaKadosh Baruch Hu in creating holiness in this world. And the Beis Halevi says, that is why the name of Hashem that is used in Bris Mila is the name Shakai Shin Dalet Yud. Shin Dalet Yud is Sha'amar Li Olam Odai. God stopped the creative process at a certain point. Right? Hashem could have allowed the wheat to turn into bread. He stopped it at a certain point so that we become his shutfim. And Refersh makes the same point. Asher Bara Elokim Lasais. Hashem created the world Lasais so that we will do it. Again, Rav Soloveitchik, in yet another way, I don't want to go into the whole analysis, analyzes this in the two accounts of Adam HaRishon in Perek Aleph. Adam HaRishon is described as B'Tselem Elokim, in the image of God, in Perek Beis. He's described as Ofer Min Hadamah, as dirt. And this emphasizes the fact that a human being must have humility and submission, but he must also recognize godlike capacities to create and to build and to take the initiative. And of course, what this means in effect is to recognize our strengths, to recognize our greatness, to recognize our potential to make a difference. And let me connect that to Hanukkah, where in effect, why should, in other words, the Jews found one day of oil. As far as they were concerned, the next day there wouldn't be anything. So why bother? Why bother to do something if the next day there'll be nothing? But Hanukkah tells us that we do what we can, and our kochos are much greater than we assume. And if we go as far as we're able to go, Hashem blesses our kochos. And that is the shutfus, the partnership that we have with the Ribono Shel Olam. And the final point I want to make, and I will end here, is that there's another message in Bris Mila too. And that is, the physical anatomical operation of Bris Mila involves cutting and exposing. That's what you do. You cut and expose. And perhaps the lesson is that true chinuch does not involve brainwashing. It does not involve changing. It involves becoming what is already there. That every yid, every person, has a special neshama, a special talent, a special avenue and kesher to the Ribono Shel Olam. And the goal of a parent, the goal of a mechanech, is to enable that person to discover their special path and their special kesher to the Ribono Shel Olam. Again, this is a very difficult issue that we have to grapple with. I don't know how we'll do it. Ideally, as the Gemara says in Bava Basra, each parent taught their child. Vishinantam levanecha. You know, Jews pride themselves, rightly so, that we were the first society in the world that had compulsory education. But if you look in the Gemara in Bava Basra, you will see it was only the takana of Rav Yeshua ben Gamla was second best. Because ideally, only a parent could really teach a child. Only a parent knows a child. Nebuch, we have to have schools. And the wonderful Rebbeim and teachers that we have are our shaluchim for that job. But how can one teacher teach 30 students, 20 students, or even 3 students? Every child is unique. Every neshama is unique. And the remez of Bris Mila, you uncover to enable the process of self-discovery, teaches us that we have to be attuned to the individuality and uniqueness of the Yachid and not create a one-size-fits-all system of education. In this connection, I came across a beautiful fable. I'll just read it to you quickly. Once upon a time, the animals decided they must do something heroic to meet the problems of a new world. They organized a school. They adopted an activity curriculum consisting of running, climbing, swimming, and flying. To make the school easier to administer, all the animals had to take all of the subjects. The duck was excellent in swimming, better in fact than the teacher, and made passing grades in flying, but he was very poor in running. Since he was slow in running, he had to stay after school. He also had to drop swimming to practice running. This was kept up until his webbed feet were badly worn, and he was only average in swimming. But average was okay, so nobody worried about that except the duck. The rabbit was at the top of the class in running, but he had a nervous breakdown from the stress of so much makeup work in swimming. The squirrel was excellent in climbing, but he developed frustrations in the flying class because his teacher made him stop from the ground up instead of from the treetop down. He also developed a Charlie horse from overexertion and got a C in climbing and a D in running. The eagle was a problem child and had to be disciplined severely. In the climbing class, he beat all the others, but he insisted in using his own way to get to the top of the tree. At the end of the year, the only one that did well was an abnormal eel that could swim exceedingly well and also run, climb, and fly, and he became valedictorian. The prairie dog stayed out of school and fought the tax levy because the administration would not add digging and burrowing into the curriculum. Okay. This was written, by the way, in a Jewish magazine, and it ends, "Does this fable have a moral?" I'm not familiar with local conditions. I will leave that for you to contemplate. But once again, the issue of one size fits all, of not recognizing our own individual kesher to the Ribono Shel Olam, is indeed a very, very great tragedy. We know the Zohar statements that there are, in fact, the word Yisrael is Yeh, Shishim, Riba, Yosios, LaTorah. There are 600,000 letters in the Torah. Okay, the number is indeed a problem, but according to the Torah, there are 600,000 letters. There are 600,000 basic neshamos that left Mitzrayim. Every Yid, neshama, has their own letter in the Sefer Torah. And that's when we ask Hashem, V'sein chalkeinu b'sorasecha, show us what my portion is. And many of us go through our whole lives, perhaps most of us, without ever really finding out what it is we are supposed to be. The greatness that is within, the talent that is within, how often does it get crushed and destroyed because no one was attuned to try to bring out that uniqueness? And that is the final lesson of the Bris Milah, to uncover, not to change and not to brainwash, but simply to uncover. Let me end with a final thought of the Sfas Emes about Hanukkah once again. If you remember, the Gemara says in Shabbos, the famous arguments between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, where Beis Shammai says the way you light Hanukkah candles is you start with 8 and you go down, and Beis Hillel, we paskin like Beis Hillel, says you start with 1 and you go up. And the Gemara gives 2 explanations to this machlokas, but the second explanation that it gives is that Beis Shammai says that the Neros Hanukkah have to correspond to the Korbanos of Sukkos, and the 70 Purim, the 70 bulls, diminish in number. So too, Ner Hanukkah diminishes in number. Beis Hillel says, Malin Bakodesh, we go up in holiness. Well, Beis Hillel seems to be clear enough. You go up in holiness. But what is Beis Shammai drawing a connection somehow between the Korbanos of Sukkot and Hanukkah? Like, what's going to be the connection? All right, some actually want to say, if you look in the book of the Maccabees, Sefer HaMaccabim, which is it's not part of Tanakh, obviously, but you do see that on some level, some of the Hanukkah observances were designed to make up, because that year they couldn't celebrate Sukkot because they didn't have the custody of the Beis HaMikdash. There is indeed a kesher, and that might be merumas obliquely in Beis Shammai's correlation. But the Sfas Emes says a very beautiful thought. When we look at the Hanukkah candles, what is it that we're looking at? On one level, of course, we're looking at the light of the Shechina. But on the other level, we're looking at an neshama of a human being. Ner Hashem Nishmas Adam. The soul of a human being is also a ner. We're looking at our souls. It is a mirror into ourselves. But when a soul is compared to fire, fire has 2 functions. Fire can destroy and burn up, and fire can illuminate in warmth. Beis Shammai says, the ideal of tshuva is one should relentlessly look at their evil aspects of their personality and surgically remove them one by one by one by one. If the imagery of soul fire is to burn away the evil, the tshuva of sur meira, then hopefully it should be a diminishing process. Meaning, day one, I got eight things I got to burn away. Day two, I got seven things, etc. That's the process. But Beis Hillel argues that that might be a proper tshuva for a tzaddik gomor. But most of us cannot do tshuva by focusing on our negative flaws, because we get mired in depression and despair and yish. And therefore, Beis Hillel says, one should build by identifying that which they are good at and do more and more of that. And therefore, the idea of the light is not to burn the evil, but to build the good. And Beis Hillel says, building the good weakens the evil automatically. Just like Choshech is not a reality. Choshech is not a real essence. Choshech is simply the absence of light. And as you increase the light, the Choshech gets weakened. Chanukah is a very, very important time. You know, Chanukah is in between Yomim Noraim and Pesach. We're out of the orbits of Yomim Noraim, and we're not yet in the orbit of Pesach. It's precisely at this time that it was divinely ordained that we need that chizuk and inspiration, that in the choshech that engulfs all of us, there is the capacity of light to dispel that choshech. And even if we think it's hopeless, and even if we think we cannot be successful, B'nai Yisrael also thought that the light that they would light would only last one day and would have no permanence. And yet the lesson of Chanukah is, we take the first step, and then HaKadosh Baruch Hu opens up the doors. Pischuli, Pischei Shalmachat, Bichudo Shalmachat, open up for me the eye of the needle. And Hashem says, I will open up Kepischei Shalul. Thank you very much.
Whatever was said about Chinuch, I want you to know that I'm retired. If you have any questions, we would welcome. A little time is left for questions, so if you have questions or comment or ideas that you want to add, there goes one.
Well, again, I don't feel comfortable addressing a local issue directly, but I do think that it's not a one-sided thing. Meaning to say, sometimes communities have a tendency to have an automatic reaction that if our kids are going to play with non-firm kids, it's straight and it's no good and we can't have it. And I would suggest that it is necessary to also see that as potentially positive. Now, how you come out, it may be that the risks outweigh the gains. I don't want to make a judgment on that locally, but it is important that the other side of the question be articulated and be addressed. It should not be seen as an obvious and clear answer. It should at least be a shadow. Yes, well, that's very good, but I would say this, again, without presuming to give the sodos of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's cheshbon, but the woman's ability to nurture and to give birth to life is a very, very potent example of a partnership with God. Now, of course, the male's role is not totally insignificant there, although, by the way, with cloning, with human cloning, men may be rendered totally superfluous, women would not be. But I think the notion of the woman as mother is a tremendously potent idea of having a godlike function within the body. I should also say, too, a comment that the Maharal makes in Ner Chanukah, interestingly enough, that If we look at bris milah as sanctification of the physical, the Maral intimates that women as a general matter have an innate sense of how to sanctify the physical world without the need for an external symbol. He even says that's why, you know, the famous Sheva Brachos Vort from the Gemara and Yevamos, that man and woman have the name of Hashem, Yud and Hey, and take it out, you have fire. But the Maral says, Hey is the letter by which God created Olam Hazeh, and Yud is the letter of Olam Haba, and the Maral has a whole cheshbon that women have the letter Hey because they're able to bring the Yud into the Dalet, that means the spiritual, into the four-cornered material world. So in a sense, they don't need part of the symbol of the Bris Milah.
Okay. There's an answer to every question. So if you want to enjoy your refreshments, you might want to do it around the table with our wonderful speaker who inspired us all. Thank you very much, Dr. Rabbi Breitowitz. I would like to ask you to give me one more chance to thank the Rabbonim of the community who joined us this evening and graced us with their presence. Thank you very much, all of you, and especially these people who are here. And I would like to acknowledge the presence of one gentleman. Please give me 1 minute. Who is a recipient of the first award that was offered in the memory of Joseph at the Presbyterian Hospital. Joseph's memory is honored at the Presbyterian Hospital annually with an award that is given to an outstanding resident for excelling in medicine and medical ethics and in human treatment of patients. Present with us tonight is the first recipient. There were already more than one, but he is the first recipient of that award, Dr. Menachem Klein. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much.